Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Really excited to be back with a new episode after our brief hiatus, and we'd really like to thank the longtime listeners who bore with us during the re-airing of our older episodes. Now, before we dive in, a quick reminder, if you're listening to The Realignment on Apple Podcasts, please scroll to the bottom of the podcast page and rate and review us 5 stars. It really helps us out, it bumps us up in the algorithm, and it helps new listeners find the show.
So this week, we're going to talk to Nick Timothy. His book is Remaking One Nation, The Future of Conservatism, and it's now available in the U.S. after coming out to very great acclaim in the United Kingdom earlier this year. And this show is all about the realignment. Now, realignments aren't just something that happens here in the United States. Realignments, political realignments, happen all over the world. And in the Anglosphere, what happened here in the United States with the election of Donald Trump was preceded very much by the Brexit referendum, by Theresa May and her prime ministership, and Nick played a very vital role in all of that. Nick wears a lot of different hats. He's a visiting professor at the University of Sheffield, he's a writer for The Telegraph, but he's best known for serving as co-chief of staff to the former UK Prime Minister Theresa May during that very tumultuous period right after that Brexit vote.
Nick is distinguished because he's not just the typical make the trains run on time chief of staff, but he's also a noted political thinker who's put a lot of thought and work into promoting the idea of one nation conservatism, which really seeks to build a broad-based coalition on the right across races, classes, and different religious and ethnic groups. And the most interesting part of this episode, then, is the discussion of political realignments and the many ways that the UK's Tory party, under the leadership of Boris Johnson, was able to lean into these realignment trends and actually cut into the Labour Party's base amongst the working class. So there's a lot of universal lessons that anyone who's studying these political realignments and how the right and the left should shift to accommodate them. Let's dive in. Nick Timothy, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me on.
So our show is really focused on the idea that the U.S. is in the middle of a political realignment that is making the Democratic Party more the party of upper middle class people, the party of college graduates, and that there's this opportunity for the Republican Party to become a party of the working class. Do you think the UK is also in a sort of realignment?
Emphatically so. I think it's been an almost lifetime thing for me that I've wanted the Conservative Party to become much more a party for working class people. That partly reflects my own background, to be perfectly honest. And actually, over the last several years, I think that realignment has shown itself to be underway. I think it was happening before the Brexit referendum, but the Brexit referendum really lit up the change in lights. But it then also sort of hastened the changes we're talking about, where you had... after the referendum, because the Brexit divide cut through the coalitions of voters and MPs that the two main parties have, it really ended up pitting lots of parliamentarians against Leave voters. And what that did was drew lots of former Labour voters who wanted to leave the European Union towards the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and you know, Nick, let's talk about that, because I think Brexit, more than anything, kind of presaged this whole realignment going on in the West. And it was something, I mean, Marshall and I definitely at the time were like, wow, like something is happening here. If you look at Brexit and the election of Donald Trump and then 2017 and so much more, it's kind of a fascinating story. And so in terms of your own role in sort of Brexit politics, when did you realize that this was an opportunity for the Conservative Party? Like, were you one of the original Brexiteers where you're like, oh, wow, like Brexit is this opportunity for me to graft my future onto? At what point did you realize that this was going to be a very precipitating event for somebody like yourself who wants to force a realignment in British politics?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say, I think, is that it's not that... it's not that leavers in the Conservative Party suddenly emerged a few years before the referendum. I mean, Britain entered the European Union in 1973, and it was quite contentious when we did. There was a referendum to retrospectively decide whether that was the right decision in 75, which was won by the advocates of membership. But it was always controversial for some people in the Conservative Party that Britain should be in the European Union. It's just that that became an increasingly mainstream view, I think, through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s.
Right.
And I think before the Brexit referendum, it had been my view for some years that it was desirable for the Tories to become a party capable of representing working class interests. It never really happened. That wasn't the electoral coalition that David Cameron was trying to build when he was leader. But then what Brexit has done is really sort of opened the gates for this, because certainly when Boris became prime minister, he knew he needed to deliver Brexit. I mean, after all, he was one of the people who had led the Brexit campaign. The senior leaders of the Leave campaign were Conservatives. The Conservatives had traditionally been for a couple of decades, the more Eurosceptic party. So he absolutely had to deliver it. And he also needed to win an election to be able to deliver it. But of course, the pre-existing Tory coalition of voters couldn't survive that, because there were many prosperous conservative voters, mainly in the sort of southeast, I think, of England, who'd voted Remain, and he was, quite likely to lose the support of many of those voters. So the only place he could go to build a winning electoral coalition was to go for those working class provincial former Labour voters who'd supported Leave, and that is indeed how he won his majority.
Mm. So this feels like a million years ago, but could you describe for us the party of David Cameron? Because when we're talking about the realignment, I think our listeners have a clear idea of what the pre-Trump Republican Party was. Low taxation, conservative on social issues, and more libertarian on economic policy. What did the David Cameron Tory party look like?
Well, it feels like such a long time ago. I might need to get some history books to remind myself. So David became leader of the party in 2005, and the party had last been in power. It was booted out in 97, and so that that 8 years in opposition is a pretty long time, especially for a party with the history that the Tories have. And David's strategy, I think, was to accept many of the tenets of the Blair years. He made the party much more socially liberal. He, in opposition, chose to associate himself with issues like climate change. Mm-hmm. He tried to show that his understanding of how people become criminal. He was lampooned for wanting to give a hug to a huddy. Which, to be fair, wasn't quite his point, but that sort of demonstrates where he was moving the party. And then events kind of intervened, and the financial crash came about. And having said he would accept Labour's spending plans, he then adopted a much more sort of fiscally conservative, hawkish policy. And so he became prime minister in 2010, having not won the election outright, and so had to form a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, which certain cynics would say suited him very well indeed, because I'm not sure how much difference there was between David and George Osborne, his chancellor and lieutenant, and Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democrats. And it meant he could shun certain factions of the Tory party, because the Liberal MPs gave him actually quite a significant majority. And in office, he was, as I say, fiscally very conservative and socially very liberal. So probably the most obvious socially liberal thing he did was introduce equal marriage. But it was a fairly liberal administration. My view is that you don't need to, it's not so much that we need to completely repudiate that liberalism. It's more that when centrists who do stand for political and economic liberalism use the language of the center, they're slightly naughty because they tend to align three different meanings. It's their own political liberalism, but it also means moderation, doesn't it? Because it's the midpoint between right and left.
Right.
And they also take it to mean that it means where moderate mainstream opinion is. But actually, all the opinion research shows that public opinion in its sort of mainstream sense tends to be slightly to the left on the economy and slightly to the right on culture, which is not where those political and economic liberals are.
Right. So you gave us the perfect segue into the book because you were describing the type of liberalism we should repudiate. That brings us into the conversation about ultra-liberals of the left and the right. So could you sort of define for us the ultra-liberalism of the left and what the ultra-liberalism of the right is and why it is that you want to repudiate it?
Yeah, so what I say in the book is we need to think about liberalism as a series of concentric circles. So at the core, I say you've got essential liberalism, which is effectively the kind of values and institutions and norms that make liberal democracy work. So a bicameral parliament, a free judiciary, an independent press, and some rights to protect minorities from the tyranny of the majority. And it should also mean a commitment to an open market economy. That can be a kind of qualified commitment because it's not sort of like market fundamentalism, but it should be an open market economy. And then at the second circle, you have a kind of elite liberalism where, the members of the governing classes, regardless of party divides, share broadly liberal views, which might be about the desirability of high immigration, multiculturalism, but also a deregulated labor market, the marketization of public services, and so on. And then you have another circle, because I don't think it's right to say that it's just as simple as their governing classes all agree and they're sort of shafting the public, because there are differences among those in the governing classes. So on the sort of outer circle, I say you've got this sort of ultra-liberalism, which has a kind of ratchet effect, where on the right you have market fundamentalists who want to sort of deregulate and marketize services. On the left you have cultural liberals who are, stand for increasingly militant forms of identity politics. And what often happens is, they may not agree with one another, but they don't really repeal what the other side has done, and they pursue right. their own liberal agenda. And the result is the same kind of social fragmentation and atomization. And so the consequences of both are pretty similar.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I'm just being struck in the way you're talking. It's like it's almost exactly the same dynamic here in the United States, right? Like we have the pairing of identity politics with kind of a woke corporatism in which the corporations are very, very, very willing and welcome to play this game because they know that it doesn't fundamentally threaten their bottom line. And if anything, it's kind of an anesthetization of any sort of class politics. And so one of the things that you said, which is, I say this all the time, as you talked about in terms of quadrants about how we think of voters, left on economics, right on culture, but even that it's not that far left and it's not that far right, and that trying to reclaim that is somehow an actually very radical political project. And that brings us to kind of what you're advocating for, which is you call it one nation conservatism. And I think the word nation there is very key. It's kind of an anti-ultra-liberal concept. And then obviously conservatism itself is, standing athwart history yelling stop. Tell us a little bit about fusing those two concepts, why it is the antidote to kind of the ultra-liberalism tugs of right and left, and what does it kind of look like when it starts to emerge as an actual political philosophy?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the idea that conservatism is about yelling at the world to stop it's a sort of fun criticism, but it's not really fair. I think it was Evelyn Waugh who said the trouble with the Conservative Party is that they've never turned the clock back 1 minute. I don't think that is what conservatism is, and it can sometimes be accused of just accommodating what others want just a bit more slowly, or and things like that. But To me, conservatism is it's about the rejection of ideology, and liberalism is an ideology. We tend not to think of it like that. We tend to think of the liberal world as this kind of natural creation, but it is an ideology. And to me, it's about a commitment to pluralism and understanding that actually values and interests are in perennial conflict with one another. And so you need institutions and norms of behavior that can help us to mediate those conflicts. It's about understanding that sort of human freedom is obviously desirable, but it's about trying to work out the ways in which we need to restrict that freedom in order to make sure that we can enjoy any kind of freedom at all. And I think this is one of the problems with the Conservative Party over the last few decades is because it's become more ideological in the way in which it's embraced economic liberalism, it's tended to put individual freedom as a value above all others.
Right.
And I don't think that is what real philosophical conservatism should do. So at the heart of conservatism for me is a sense of community. It's about the family. It's about your locality. It's about other ways in which you connect with other humans, and then the way in which those things add up to an identification with the nation. And I think the nation is really important because it is our identification with the nation that means that we're prepared to make sacrifices for our fellow citizens. And that's what makes things like, progressive taxation or universal public services and a welfare state possible. And when people stop identifying with the nation, then they start to, I think, disrespect the kind of implicit contract we have between all of us, which is what citizenship is.
Mm-hmm. So the second part of your book is the future of conservatism. And obviously everyone in the US, regardless of how the 2020 election turns out, is going to be thinking about that future. What do you think the lessons or main takeaways from the UK's experience? Because I think the clear takeaway is that realignment politics has been very successful for the Tory party in a way that they haven't been for the GOP in the US to the same degree. What should we be thinking about as we sort of look forward at these debates?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say about the British experience is it took a couple of goes.
Let's put it lightly.
Where there was this agenda and we screwed it out. This is why I've had the time to write the book and I'm not in government.
We'll cover that in the intro.
And I think one of the main reasons we screwed it up was we were only halfway there. We were effectively, I think, trying to offer a post-liberal prospectus on a neoliberal budget. Mm. We were still sort of trapped by the kind of fiscal conservatism and economics of the Cameron and Osborne years. Boris won it the second time around, and in large part, I mean, he's a far superior communicator to Theresa May. They cut out some of the mistakes that we made. But it was also partly because by the point of the 2019 election, it was beyond apparent to the public that Parliament was trying to stop Brexit.
Yes.
And that was the key. The question is whether things will revert back to normal and we'll go back to arguing about socioeconomic issues in elections, or whether these more cultural issues will come into play in those future decisions. I think the cultural side of politics is here to stay. But I think what is really important, and the Conservative Party hasn't yet sort of met this test, but I would think that the same is true of the GOP, is it's not enough to say to working class voters, look, vote for us on the following cultural grounds.
Yes.
You also have to have a prospectus that works for working class voters on economic grounds too. because it's all very well to say, oh, there's a realignment and half of it's coming in our direction. Well, half of it's going in the other direction. And so we need to learn to be more pragmatic, I think, and less ideological on the economy. And if you're trying to restore prosperity in, you know, the places that have suffered deindustrialization pretty rapidly in, say, the Midlands and the north of England or the Rust Belt in the States, then in reality, we're going to need a more strategic role for the state in making that happen.
Yeah, I want to revisit your point about post-liberalism on a neoliberal budget, because I think this is an area where, to dump my personal views into it, where I think a lot of people who are thinking about the future of the right are confused. So in the US, you see a lot of people who are talking about the GOP needs to be the party of fiscal responsibility. We need to focus on cutting entitlement programs, cutting Social Security. When if you actually look at the polling, the people that we're talking about trying to appeal to the working class base, they have no interest in that agenda. And I think in a couple of different ways, it's very clear that that agenda wouldn't serve their ends. But on the other hand, and this is to your point about the realignment going two different ways, the upper middle class suburban voters, I'm curious if this is true in the UK, who would like fiscal conservatism, are rejecting the GOP's working class cultural values. So you're going to offer it so that there's no actual coalition in favor of this sort of neoliberal economics. So I'm always just frustrated by that. Could you comment on that dynamic? Because politically, it's malpractice. We could separate the policy debate, but there just seem to be people who think that's an actual program the GOP could pass.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always slightly baffled by the language of fiscal conservatism, because it's always taken to mean that spending and taxes need to be very low. And therefore, it's not necessarily an attitude to the deficit. So you can be a conservative about a deficit and still have quite high spending. You just have to raise the taxes. So I think you have to sort of make some choices. I think here, Britain and America might have slightly different challenges because we're a pretty old society. Our old age dependency ratio has changed quite considerably over the last decade or two. And as a result, demands on public spending by health services, social care, state pensions are very, very high. And I think it's pretty difficult to imagine the overall tax burden in Britain getting very much lower anyway. So regardless of the kind of context of realignment, the agenda of just cutting taxes and that kind of thing doesn't seem like a viable proposition for the Tory party anyway.
Right. Nick, I want to get your take on this, too, because one of my pet projects is I try to get GOP lawmakers. I'll say, I believe in public policy. Do you? And the reason that the challenge that I phrase it that way is fiscal conservatism, free market fundamentalism, ultra-liberalism, as you call it, all of these things are, you know, on the right are just anti-public policy projects. Like one of the problems we have here is I see these prominent conservative intellectuals who are like, well, there was this one program that held back the New Deal. Ergo, the New Deal didn't work. And I'm like, well, why don't we just like not do that one program and we could, you know, pursue other programs? It's like if a business has a failed product, we should say there's no business anymore. It's ludicrous. I mean, that literally is how ideological so many of these people are. Does that kind of infect the Toryism? I mean, is that what, and that's one part of my question. But the second is we would be remiss if we didn't talk about this in the context of there's a lot of money behind pushing this type of ideology. There's a lot of very vested financial power behind making sure that this maintains a real ideology in power. So how do you fight against that? And how have you maybe seen, you know, we could look to Boris Johnson. Is it a success story? Is it a compromise? Should we think about that here?
Yeah, I think I'm not quite sure it's big money pushing these things in Britain. Mm-hmm. I think for some people, they have an ideology and they believe it. And a lot of it is connected to sort of old loyalties. You know, this is all very different to what Margaret Thatcher would have done. Margaret Thatcher left office in 1990. The world is quite different. And so I think for some people it's about that. Actually, for some people in the Tory party, I think the class thing matters. Some people feel very uneasy talking about class, which I just think is crazy. It's there, it's visible. It's a way of understanding how many millions of people live and what their challenges are. And to deny that it's relevant is to show that you're disconnected from reality. And maybe it shows that you just don't care. So I think it's really important that the party does talk and think in those terms. So I think in many ways in Britain, it's a kind of cultural thing. I mean, sure, there are party donors who think things, and they certainly wouldn't want chancellors to go after the city or something like that. But there's one of the things to remember is there's just a lot less money in British politics than there is in American politics.
That's a good point.
So,
Nick, I'd be remiss if I didn't make a poorly timed joke and point out the history ended in 1990. So we don't actually have to assume that things could change or anything. But no, to go back to an earlier remark, you made a comment that sort of gets at these realignment political debates that are, cross-Atlantic. You made the point that in the UK, there's an aged population. That brings up immigration. And if I put on my neoliberal hat, I say, exactly, Nick, that's why Brexit is a bad thing. That's why cutting Britain off from, populations that want to migrate throughout the world is going to be a bad thing because society won't be sustainable. How should we think of that debate? Because obviously the U.S. population is younger, but we have the same long-term population growth issues. So how should we think of that part of this debate?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I think a lot of the people who say, stop moaning about job insecurity or stop moaning about the lack of protections at work, this is just the future because technology is sort of changing jobs or destroying jobs and, take your UBI and be grateful. Are also the same people who say, oh, well, of course, we need loads more immigration to be able to pay for the pensions for the old people. Mm-hmm. Those two positions aren't entirely coherent when put alongside one another. I don't know how you feel about the debate in the States on immigration, but certainly here, the people who argue for more immigration tend to do so in a fairly dishonest way. So they know that they will lose the argument if they take on public opinion and say, guys, what we really need is annual net migration to be about 500,000 a year.
Right.
What do you mean that's the size of a couple of cities' growth a year? They'd lose that argument, but what they do is they say, well, it's not actually possible to control immigration in this age of easy travel and communication and so on, or the numbers probably should be controlled, but not this particular visa route. This one's vital, and then they'll do the same with every other visa route, and they'll do the same about illegal immigration too. And they'll say that when people say they're concerned about immigration, they're not really angry about immigration. They're just upset that they don't have a great job anymore. And they'll try to shift. They'll take direct quotes from people who say, "I am concerned about immigration," and will justify that concern by talking about something else because they don't want to argue on a kind of cultural dividing line that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fascinating. I want to bring that actually back to something you said. I think cultural politics are here to stay. So when we're talking about cultural politics, and as we both know, I mean, offering your working class base kind of a cultural stick and being like, here you go, guys, like this is all we're going to get you, but we're going to screw you whenever it comes to your bank account, is not enough in terms of a winning strategy. So how does one nation? It's also status quo, I think, especially here in the United States. But so under this dynamic in which culture war is here to stay, in which most politicians actually see a lot of success from only delving in the cultural stuff, they can continue their you know, neoliberal tax policy all they would like and not get called out for it. How do we incentivize the one nation conservatism you're advocating for, I mean, realignment politics, whatever you want to call it? Like, how do we make that politically salient in an all culture war politics?
Well, I mean, I think partly you can make that argument in the kind of moral terms that I sense that we all would.
Sure. Yeah, but I think these people are so cynical. Honestly, I think they're deeply cynical. And I've always said the way that we win is to make our politics the cynical choice, because then they're like, this is how you win. That's just how you do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought Brits were supposed to be the cynical ones and Americans the sort of naive optimists. maybe I'm the naive optimist.
My mom grew up in the UK, so I think I've got
that. Oh, there you are. Yeah. you got the cynical gene. I think on some level I would definitely try to make the case on moral grounds, but I think you can also say that this is part about arresting national decline and reversing it. Mm-hmm. Because this isn't just about the fact that large numbers of people in our countries are economically insecure. It's not just that is a question of economic and social justice, but a strong community, deep inequality and poverty does not make. And if you want to be safe, you should want your fellow citizens to have a certain standard of living. If you want your country to be strong in the world, you should want all the engines firing. In the modern economy, the most important asset a country has is its human capital. Yeah. And we're literally allowing a significant percentage of our human capital to rot. And so maybe for some of these people, the argument is best put in terms of national prosperity and strength.
Mm-hmm. So here's a question, though, right? So what do we do if people aren't interested in this sort of project of national greatness, if you don't really care about national decline, right? Because, to bring it into the present day, we're in a world where, President Ulysses S. Grant is having his, statue toppled in the U.S. You're seeing Winston Churchill,
defaced. Boxed up or whatever.
Boxed right? up and defaced in the UK.
These guys are never going to be on our side. They are the opponents.
So, right. but they're the... Yes, yeah, so it agreed, right, that you're not going to sort of convince Antifa to sort of support the project. But at the same time, though, the fact that those events are going on illustrates the fact that the national project itself is more vulnerable than ever. And it's harder and harder for people in the moderate middle to articulate the case for that. So how do you sort of, because that's something, if you'd gone back, to 2017, I think a lot of people in the U.S. were excited about the One Nation Conservatism project because it seemed to offer a third way, right? And to mix up our neoliberal metaphors here, because it seemed to sort of say, hey, there's a world where we can be more populist in some degrees, but also, in the sense of being democratic and representing the will of the people, but we could also unify people in a way that I think the worst parts of populism can't do. But it's hard to do that when there isn't an agreed upon sort of consensus on that nation. So, I mean, that's just a lot of thoughts. But how should we be thinking about this? Because I think this is what the project needs to be going forward, regardless of how post-Brexit or post-2020 election goes in the US.
Yeah, well, I mean, my view is that conservatives need to recognize that there are battles going on about cultural issues, and they need to stand up for conservative values and the values of many millions of voters who feel unled on these causes. But it doesn't mean that we should do that in a really divisive way, right? So the problem with a lot of these cultural arguments is that they're polarizing, and the outcomes presented are binary. Do you believe in tearing down a statue of Robert Peel, who, by the way, they want to tear down the statue because his dad had investments in the slave trade, not him?
Who's Robert Peel for our audience?
A mid 19th century British prime minister.
Got it.
You know, do you want to tear down a statue of Robert Peel, or are you a racist? Is basically the sort of like weird binary thing.
By the way, you just gave us the title of the episode. That's
But I think it's really important that conservatives don't fall into those kinds of traps and start playing to the worst elements in our society, right? So I think the much more reasonable position is, of course, we should totally respect people with gender dysphoria. But no, that doesn't mean we should now pass legislation that undermines a woman's right to privacy and security. Of course, there's not only still racism, there's also disparities in the experiences and lives of people based on their ethnic background. And we should do lots to try to fix that. But no, we don't want to tear down statues and to try to erase elements of our country's histories. I think it's really important that conservatives reject those kinds of polarizing strategies, reject binary outcomes, and make sure that that kind of moderate, reasonable opinion, which is, you know, I'm proud of my country and I love it for you know, warts and all in terms of its history, but at the same time, I want to be fair to every one of our citizens.
Right.
So how do we think about that, though? Because I think, you know, the two cases of this, right, you know, obviously no one on this call wants Robert Peel, Winston Churchill, or Ulysses S. Grant defaced, but the US and the UK both have complicated histories, right? With the UK, obviously, that's the legacy of, you know, the British Empire and sort of the worst parts of colonialism. With the US, that's the Confederacy and the Civil War and the Jim Crow South. So how... there's this debate on the right, and this is what everyone we know is talking about, which is how much ground can you give, or if any, right? So if you say, hey, you know, like this U.S. military base that is named after a Confederate general, yeah, I could see giving that up.
Yeah.
But does that then lead to the defacement of the Ulysses S. Grant, which is what somebody, and I think you should add to that.
Yeah,
too,
I mean, I see that, which is that there's this huge debate, right? Which is that, oh, if you give here, it's a slippery slope. I mean, slippery slope is not really a fallacy. It's actually true. And I think that it's very difficult to navigate publicly because you don't want to be, you know, in favor of like a statue of a virulent racist general.
Just put up in the 20s,
right? Put up in 1920, literally for the purpose of expressing racism. But you also don't want to give in on the cultural front. And I know these are difficult questions, but I think, you know, it's incumbent on the right for people who want to be moderate to try to think through it. So what is your standard? How do you think through it?
Well, I mean, I think there are similarities here. So the I don't know if you've seen this, but there was a statue of a guy called Edward Colston in Bristol that was pulled down by a mob quite recently. Colston was a slave trader. You know, Bristol was at the heart of the slave trade, and his statue was only put up many years after his death and after the slave trade had been abolished in Britain.
Right.
And I think almost everybody, I think, seems to agree that, yeah, it's probably, you know, it's wrong that Colston should be commemorated in that way without any kind of explanation of his links to slavery. I think the plaque beneath him just said he was a philanthropist, he did great things for Bristol. People like Colston, you know, his statue, like, you know, put it in a museum, explain it. You know, there is actually, I think, a museum about the slave trade in Liverpool, which is another British city connected to the trade. So I think conservatives can definitely do that kind of thing, but I think it's really important that conservatives always stand for the rule of law. You know, these things aren't done by the mob; they're done by proper and formal decision making. And we also stand up for the histories of our culture, because firstly, that is how we understand how pluralistic societies came about. You know, Britain's pluralism came about from through the context in which people started to realize it was probably a bad idea to keep killing one another about, you know, theological differences between Anglicanism and Catholicism.
Right.
And you know, we became sort of more reasonable and more pluralistic over time. But it's important that we understand how we did that, because the problem, one of the problems with liberalism is this, and it is connected to liberal philosophy, I think, this idea that we are inevitably, inexorably going to become an ever more perfect society. And it's a combination of the sort of trial and error of a pluralistic society and our own rationality that delivers it. As soon as you justify pluralism on those grounds, then liberalism ends up becoming illiberal pretty quickly, because whoever disagrees with you about what progress is like almost by definition like irrational or nefarious.
Yeah,
I think it's really important in the terms of understanding pluralism to understand our histories. It's also really important to understand our histories and tell stories about our histories that, I still need to be made inclusive, because it's the stories we tell about ourselves that help to foster the sense of national identity that makes all the good stuff that we should all want to do in terms of citizenship and sacrifice and doing better for poorer people in our countries. It's those common stories that make that national identity possible, that makes those things possible.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the last section here really, which is that your book was written before the coronavirus, before, COVID-19 pandemic came out. And so much of what we've learned kind of since then. Do you think anything that you've written has been vindicated as a result of the political process that's been defined as because of COVID-19? What lessons have you learned from it? And maybe what would you have included if you were writing it right now?
I'm entirely vindicated by every event.
As are we.
That's right.
Yeah, everyone too, wins,
by the way.
Right. I think, I obviously didn't know the pandemic was coming, and I can't believe I didn't mention a virus or pandemic just once, which would have made me look really prescient. I think broadly speaking, the arguments in the book still remain valid, and maybe even more valid, because I think what the pandemic is showing is the importance of interdependency within countries. So we bailed out business again, the second time in just a bit more than a decade. In Britain, the health services relied on volunteers coming back to add to the workforce, people volunteering from different parts of the NHS to go into specialist COVID wards at personal risk for themselves. I think it's really reminded people of the importance of community and citizenship and so on. But I think it's also going to lead to a fairly significant demand for much more resilience, like local and national, and much more state capacity. And it's also, I think, going to lead to, hopefully this would be across the West, but I think in truth it will be more so in some countries rather than others, a much more skeptical attitude towards China. And the nature of modern supply chains and transnational production networks.
Yeah,
I think that's the perfect note to end on. And I think that
I don't think transnational production networks is actually the perfect note.
Well, if you listen to The Realignment, that that's what we're talking about. So
we specialize in pushing that take out, so we appreciate it.
All right, Nick, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks,
fantastic buddy. Conversation. I really recommend everybody go buy the book. All right.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode.
As always, share this podcast with your friends and your family. Rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out in the algorithm and elsewhere, and we could not appreciate it more. We will see you guys next week.